uncensored, no holds barred talk. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. This is the Global Reality Radio Network.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to another live edition of the Global Reality right here on the Global Reality Radio Network. With me, your host, Josh Reeves. Thanks for being with us here tonight for another late night Moonbat edition of the broadcast. It is the Thursday edition of the show. May 24th, 2012 into Friday, May 25th, 2012. Thank you so much for being with us here tonight. We're going to be getting into some news for you here. Not a whole lot tonight. Again, while we're starting later. And we're going to also be continuing our series of reading the lost artifacts of ancient America, whatever it's called. Yeah, we're going to be continuing that. It's been good stuff so far. And that's been, it's been the headspace I've been in working on this latest project. So it's been enjoyable to talk about that. But, today was kind of a strange, it was a weird day today, I tell you. Today was like a microcosm of what life is usually always is, which is, you know, the highest of highs and the lowest of lows, peaks and valleys, you know. And because I sort of started out the day thinking that this project was going to be off and that I wasn't going to be able to do it, and I pretty much was conceding defeat earlier in the day today. Strangely enough, it's weird because, you know, we just hadn't got in the support that we needed, and we've only got a week left on our fundraiser and all that stuff. So I was kind of, you know, I was just like, all right, you know, it's not going to happen. I don't have a budget. I can't continue. And yesterday I had talked about getting contacted by Left Right Productions again, and I had heard from them about almost a year ago. And this project sort of never got off the ground until now. And so she was contacting back all the people they had contacted before to see if they were still interested in doing this. And so I told her that I was, talked to her today. And very nice lady. And somebody who's got a really good eye for talent. I'm not just saying that because she likes me. But she's, you know, it seems to have, apparently from what I've read, seems to have an eye for picking out, you know, unique personalities in a lineup and stuff. So so she said that they're contacting people about the show, and she said, you know, that they wanted me to work in a variety of fashions, which I'm, you know, absolutely okay with. That's really cool. She said that they want to have, like, multiple hosts, like a few different types of hosts, and then I guess those people would be sort of having commentary and maybe even debate over the different facts surrounding whatever case it is, or whatever homicide case it is, past or present, new or old, whatever it may be. And she even asked me if there was anybody I would be interested in having on as another host. She literally said, oh, excuse me. I haven't sneezed on air very much, but there was one time. Woof, you just can't even avoid it. But she said, you know, basically, if there's anybody in the world that I wanted to be, you know, have another host on to sort of, you know, have banner with, I guess, or somebody that you might want to argue with, you know, of course, my first choice would be Bill Shatner. You know, I'm not going to throw that at her. She'd probably say no. But, you know, she said anybody, so I'm thinking, hey, all right. But I know, it's, you know, I was kind of thinking of different things. But anyway, they want me to do a variety of things, like, I guess, co-host. I guess maybe even be like, you know, an expert or something. And they also are talking about, like, you know, participating in, like, reenactments and stuff that they do, which I think would just be fucking fun as hell. So, so after she told me about that, she really didn't, that's really all the information she gave me. She didn't say anything else about the show, any details, just said, you know, they're contacting the people that they're interested in for it. And then she asked me what I was doing for the rest of this year. And I told her I was working on this project, this film project. It's kind of hard to, you know, you guys have heard me out, you know, how long I've been going off about this stuff. It's kind of hard to encapsulate it in a small amount of time, but I was just telling her about it, and she was freaking out. I mean, freaking out in a good way. She was really freaking out because she, and this blew my mind, but it makes total sense to me now. And I really understand something about the whole industry that I didn't understand before, that now I know is an absolute fact, is that, she said that the archaeological shows and stuff are really hot right now. But that every time they try to find somebody to do one, all they can find are these stuffy academic types, and people don't want to watch that. People want something that's real, and they want something that's, you know, do-it-yourself, grassroots, real type of person going out and doing this. And I was telling her about, you know, the rock wall, and I was telling her about going to all these places and documenting, and she was just freaking out. And so she said that she wants to put together, she wants me to pitch a show to her people. She sent me over the paperwork and everything. I mean, this is the real deal. To pitch a show to her people that is basically what my film is. Like, you know, the Lost Secrets of Ancient America. The show. Where I would go around to all these different sites and, you know, do archaeological digs and discoveries, and they would film it all. She's literally talking about wanting to pitch a show like that. And she said that even after that, after the United States stuff was done, she said, are there other sites around the world? And I said, you bet your ass there is. There's places all over the place. She's like, okay, well, we could expand it to that, too, throughout the whole world. So they're talking about not only giving me this homicide show, but also possibly giving me my own show where I'll be able to go out and do all this stuff, and it'll be out. I mean, I'm just, you got to understand, I went from starting my day thinking out that I was, it was over, to getting news that, I'm going to be pitching a television show. I have the paperwork in hand. I mean, I never thought I'd be filling out a pitch, but she made it sound like it was, you know, pretty much 100% assured. I mean, she did. I even said, you know, is it going to be a problem? Some of this, you know, stuff that I'm going to be, that I get into, that, you know, the powers that be don't really like that stuff. She said not to worry about that. So, but you know, I've just got to be careful and not, I'm not going to give them everything I got. You know what I mean? I'm gonna pitch this show in a very, you know, in a way where I get them interested. But anyway, she wants me to basically put together, like, I guess, kind of a promo reel, and that's what I'm gonna do. I'm shifting gears to that. So I'm gonna put together this promo reel to, I guess, take all the stuff I have so far and condense it into something that. Because the crazy thing is I was already making this film to be like a TV show. I was going to be kind of making it like a TV show so that it would be, you know, maybe easier for people who are used to seeing things presented in that way to take the information in. So I've already been coming at this film from that standpoint, you know, because, like I said before, people have been asked, oh, you know, you're going to get into the ancient alien thing and this and the other. And as I've said before, you don't even really have to. I don't have to with this. But the information, when you, all my research directly takes you to things that are, yes, talked about in Sumerian clay tablets. It's unbelievable. But this could be, I mean, to me, this sounds like this could be an opportunity to be able to use their resources to do, you know, digs, go out and do and excavate some of these things that have been long buried. I mean, I know about places all over the place. Yeah, we can do America first, and we can move on to South America after that. And after we're done with that, we can move on to a whole bunch of other places all around the whole world that they don't do TV shows about. Because I know where a bunch of them are. But you want to do it? You want me to do it? I'm there. Let's do this. Rock on. You know, fuck it. But I was, you know, I was just really blown away by that. I was not expecting, because I'd mentioned that last night, you know, maybe down the road, get my foot in the door or something, maybe I can pitch an idea to him. And I didn't dream I'd be, last night when I said that I would be pitching that today. But she seems very interested in you know, basically, I mean, dude, I've got a ton of ideas. I mean, don't even give me that. They're acting like it's blank check. They're acting like, well, you know, whatever you give us, we'll do. Let's do it. And I'm like, don't tell me that, because I, you better get a pen. I got a lot of shit in this brain, man. A lot of ideas. But my point is, what I learned, my lesson I learned here from this, I already knew this was happening for years in the music industry, but it's gotten so bad it's permeated all industries now. But for I've talked about this here on the show before. The way the music industry is, people always that write, you know, lyrics like what Jamie Reeves and Delphi or whatever were writing in the Demigods with a band I was in, and those kind of songs like what Muse writes, you know, stuff that's kind of like anti New World Order, anti Illuminati stuff, and people wonder, you know, how those artists can be on big major labels. And the fact of the matter is, they don't give two shits of a motherfucking rat's ass what you talk about as long as you sell. You can write songs about the record label owner's mother and how you sodomized her and dug her up and fucked her skull and then put her back in her bed. And I mean, you can write whatever you want, dude. You can call the fucking producer's wife a whore. They don't give a fuck if you sell. And so that kind of answers the question people that I've been asking for the past few years is, why are they allowing stuff like this stuff on Ancient Aliens to come out now? Why are they allowing this on TV? And the fact of the matter is, folks, they're hurting. They're hurting like everybody else is. And as she told me, she straight up told me today, people do not want a show with stuffy academic types on it. It won't sell, but archaeological shows and people going out and finding stuff does sell. And so what they're essentially what it is that they're allowing stuff like this and stuff like I do to be on TV now because they don't have a choice. I mean, the audiences have become more sophisticated. That's a big-time problem for movie makers. Audiences know what to expect. They know every gag. They've seen it all. They know every joke. Everything's old. You know, there's nothing new under the sun. So they're presented with the challenge of having to do this. And what's interesting is that the idea of being able to put something out there where people can see that it's, you know, I mean, I don't have a degree in anything. Like I said last night, I don't have any fucking business even being on TV. I don't have a degree in archaeology, or that's how they tried to do that to David Hatcher Childress, so I expect they'll try to do that to me, but I'll just be upfront about it. I don't have a degree in anything. I have no qualifications whatsoever other than I've been in media for a long time doing this show, 5 years. I've gotten good at what I do. I'm great at keeping the information. I've got a personality. But the thing about it is that with David Hatcher Childress, they tried to discredit him. Oh, he's, you know, he calls himself an archaeologist, but he doesn't have an archaeological degree, you know. So what that discredit, what, you, I mean, they, there's this, you know, this stupid mindset that somehow you have to have a degree in archaeology or you don't know what the fuck you're talking about. Because when you have a degree in archaeology, the only way you get that degree is to regurgitate out of your left brain the shit that they have programmed into you. And there's no room for editing. So, you know, my thing about this is that, I mean, this whole project, all this stuff that I've wanted to do and uncover, I mean, this may very well be it. If it's not, if it doesn't work out, well, so what? No love lost. But I don't know, man. The way she was talking, it was not sounding like this was a, you know, she didn't put it, because I didn't ask to pitch this show. She asked me what I was working on. And when I told her what I was working on, she started freaking out, saying that would be perfect for a show. She's like, my God, that we need something like that. That'd be perfect for what we're looking for. We totally, you know, people don't want a stuffy academic type. They want a real guy, and a guy, you know, somebody like you that's just doing this to do it because they feel it's the right thing to do. And, you know, that's, to me, the idea. I mean, if they want to do a show like that, that's fucking pretty rad, you know? That's pretty fucking awesome, I would think. Because to me, you'd have an opportunity to inspire people to do it themselves. And if that's all I get out of this, man, that's good enough for me. I mean, that would be awesome. I mean, I don't know if that's going to be the case when it comes down to, you know, stuff, shit changes. But that's the idea that you had for the show, was pitching it as, you know, here's a guy who doesn't have a degree or whatever else, but look what he's finding. Look what he's dug up. You know, look at this. Look at the angle of this. You can do this too. You know, it will inspire people on a lot of different levels. So that to me is like the main thing that I think is the best. And obviously, you know, getting to actually, because I'm going to be doing this stuff anyway. I mean, it's really, is it any different than if, you know, some listeners funded, or if some TV network funds it? I mean, I don't care who funds it, as long as I get to do it and get the information out there and go and find the truth on my own. But the opportunity to be able to go around, just like we were talking about last night, the Madden Cruiser. Oh, it's on now. I'm definitely putting that in there. I'm definitely putting that in the script. It's going to be, I need the Madden Cruiser. Networks love that too, especially when they can recycle something. That's their favorite. Like they used to do in the old TV shows. They'd recycle the sets. And you ever see anything shit like that back in the day in the old TV shows? Yeah. You'd be watching like, Eight is Enough. Not Eight is Enough. Facts of Life. You'd be watching Facts of Life, and somebody would come around the corner, and then you'd notice, you're like, wait a minute, that's fucking Jack Tripper's apartment. You guys didn't even change the set. You know, stuff like that. But yeah, man, I mean, it's totally exciting. I mean, it's kind of a twofer deal. I was just kind of like, you know, they wanted me to do this homicide show thing. And maybe that'll pan out. Maybe it won't. But I wasn't expecting to have a twofer here, you know. Yeah, we want you to do this. And by the way, what you're working on sounds like a great idea for a TV show. How about you pitch it to my? How about I pitch it to my people? And she sent me over the forms and the proposal and all this. And I'm not just gonna send it back to her tomorrow, though. I mean, I want some time to work on it because, like I said, you know. I don't want to give away all my pearls. I'm not just going to look, let's be honest here. I don't have an entertainment lawyer. I don't have an agent. I'm in a position where I could get fucked. Where they could take my ideas, take everything that I've worked on, and legally, cuz they have no legal binding contract to not take somebody's ideas. None at all. None whatsoever. I'm on no contract with these people. I've not one iota had, you know, I've been dealing with their talent agent, who normally would be dealing with an agent, but I'm dealing directly with them. So I have to sort of be kind of informatively vague with how I present it, because, you know, again, who's to say that they couldn't just do all the things that I had planned to do. And then replace me with some putts, and then they don't put the whole truth out. But yet the show still goes on. You see what I mean? I can't risk that. I'm not saying that would happen, but I'm just saying, somebody in my position, when you start playing at that level, you got to be careful. You know, you got to make sure and CYA at all times. I mean, that's, if I've learned anything, that's the main thing I've learned, is that, you know, you got to CYA. And, yeah, that's definitely part of it, but we'll see what happens. I definitely left talking to her today very excited, and she was very excited about it. And I didn't even get to even scratch the surface. I even told her about how, you know, a lot of people want this stuff covered up. And she said, well, you know, are you talking about people that are afraid that it's going to challenge their religion and things like that? And I said, yeah, is that a problem? She said, no, not at all. And I said, all right, cool. Long as you're not afraid to piss off the churches, I mean, I'm down. Because, you know, Oh, man. There's going to be some butt-hurt motherfuckers if this goes down. Going to be butt-hurt. Motherfucking butt-hurt. Oh, man. You will know the apocalypse is upon us when you see my monkey ass on TV. Put that on a t-shirt. Sell it. So, yeah, it's definitely exciting, and I'm just very blessed and grateful for even being considered for it, because I've never wanted it, and I don't like TV, and I don't watch TV, and TV sucks dick, and I hate it and think it's one of the worst things in the world. But, you know, like, if somebody thinks I can do something, they think I'm the man for the job, I mean, who am I to argue? I'll give it a shot and see if, you know. Because I know I can do this, man. I'm comfortable being in front of a microphone. I'm comfortable being in front of a camera. I'm comfortable in my own skin. I can be myself. I hate to see myself on camera or whatever. I'm not really a big fan of that. I don't mind hearing my own voice, but, you know, I really don't like really seeing myself too much. But, I mean, look, you only live once, and you only get so many opportunities. And my thing about this is, you know, I gotta try this and just see. I just gotta see what happens with it. You know what I mean? Just cause. I mean, you know, you would. It's not every day somebody asks you to not only be on one show, but to also pitch a show of your own. But I guess, you know, I mean, I guess it is to be expected. There's people who spend their whole lives trying to get on TV. And I've never cared about that. It's not a big deal to me, and it's still not. It never will be. But at the same time, I'm not going to turn down an opportunity if it means that it can further what I'm doing, especially in the resource department. You know, that's why I said I would do this show, this homicide show, that really doesn't have anything to do with the kind of stuff that I get into. But I'll do it if they'll pay me, because that can fund all this stuff. You know, as far as I'm concerned, I can go on TV and be a fucking a total retard. Beep, beep, beep. Let's go out to Marco Pichu and do acid, bip, dip, whatever. But this is my work, and this is what I do. And, you know, if I have to look at going and doing these TV shows as a day job to pay for this, then that's just something I'm going to look at doing. And, you know, who knows? Who knows what happened? But the biggest thing for me is that it could really be an opportunity to not only gain some resources to make, you know, more and more films of my own, you know, and do more independent films and better quality stuff, and have more reach, and also to inspire people to do it on their own too. You know, that you, I hope that's my biggest goal. I mean, I got to say it again. That's my biggest goal. That's what I want to do with this. That's with this opportunity. That's what I want to do the most, more than anything else. Is if I can get an opportunity to speak to a large audience on a cable TV show and get people inspired, regular people like me, you know, I never thought I'd be doing anything like this ever. I always knew I was going to do something big. You could say that's ego or whatever, but from the time I was a little kid, I always knew I was going to do something big. I just never knew what it was going to be. And that's why I could never settle in my life for having the regular life like everybody else has. And that's something nobody could ever understand with me. And I've had to live with that burden my whole life. And I still do, and I always will. But that's just the way it is, man. But you have to be willing to be considered a weirdo and to be, you know, not a societal norm. And, oh, why don't you have a regular job? And why don't you, you know, why aren't you married and have kids? I mean, you have to understand that, you know, that's the things that got me here are those things of living my whole life outside of what's considered normal, you know? And I don't know how. I've always just known that instinctively that's what I had to do to be able to make it to the point in my life where something big was going to happen. And it is. And it has been. It's just been up and up and up since I've been doing this radio show. I mean, yeah, we struggle and we barely get by every month paying the bills and everything else, but you know, we've made it, and we're here. We've been here for almost 5 years. And, I mean, we could really, really further the research, I think, and at least, you know, fund a few more projects. Shit, I mean, if I go and do this once or one show and another show and it doesn't work out or whatever, hey, no love lost. you know, I'm still always going to do this no matter what happens. You know, but the fact of the matter is, I mean, this morning I was just like, it's over. The film's over. We're not going to be able to fund it or do anything. We still need your help with that. One person did donate. Thank you for that to that person. But, yeah, it's just a thing where, I don't know. I can't explain it. How does that happen? I was saying, you know, I'm done. I'm at a standstill. I can't go any further. No budget, no money to work, you know. And then, boom, I finally get a hold of her and talk to her, and she lays that on me. So I've got to shift towards making this look at this promo reel thing. I mean, they're going to eat this shit up like catfish, man. I'm telling you what. Because, you know, the first thing that a bunch of people I know said to me when the show Ancient Aliens first came on was, you know, why aren't you on that show? You should be on that show. These guys are like stealing all your shit you were talking about like 3 years ago. And I was like, well, they won't let me on that show because I'm not a big enough putz. That's the first thing. Watch, I say that now, and they'll be calling me. Only if I get to touch Tupacalypse's fucking hair. That's all I want. No. But, you know, that's the thing. I mean, they put these people, they get on these shows sometimes. It's just like, where the fuck did you find this guy? I'm sure people are already going to be saying that about me, but, man. It's just ridiculous sometimes. They'll bring out these people on these shows and they'll be talking about, like, you know, extraterrestrials on Anunnaki, and it'll be like, you know, underground something something researcher, and it'll always be somebody you've never fucking heard of in a million years. You go look them up and there's like no archive shows on them or anything. You know, they just, some of these people just appear out of nowhere sometimes. TheGlobalReality.com is my website where this broadcast originates from. That's TheGlobalReality.com. You can also send emails anytime, GlobalRealityShow@gmail.com. That's GlobalRealityShow@gmail.com. And that's where you can, I love to have emails anytime. I mean, you can send me over anything. If you have questions during the show, you have comments, you have something you want me to, you know, get my opinion about, get my take on. Ask me a question. Hey, I'm open, you know. There's got to be something. Let's see if we have any emails here tonight. No, I don't think we do. But I did get an email from Nick Spiro, and he sent this article. Good find, Nick. This is all. I mean, this is, I guess this came out last year, August 2nd, 2011 is the date on this article. But the plan would connect Missouri and Illinois mounds. So I think they're planning on connecting these various mound structures in Cahokia, near St. Louis in the Illinois border. A meeting to discuss a bike trail that would link Cahokia Mounds with the sole remaining Missouri Mound is scheduled for August 4th. A bike trail on existing roads, a separate bike path, and a creation of an auto tour are all among options. Well, it'd be interesting, Nick, if you could find out if this was approved and went through or whatever. Interesting that they'd want to reconnect those. Because, you know, think about it. Back when those were constructed, there were no borders. That's why the... Oh, I can't tell you that yet. Never mind. Let's just say, yeah, a lot of these structures spread out through different states, but they're actually interconnected. The borders are there because we created the borders, but a lot of these mound structures intersect through multiple states over great vast distances, and they actually connect with each other and actually relate to each other in many very interesting ways, which I'll tell you about in the new film. So thanks for that article there, Nick. Be cool to find out if that actually went through. let's get into the news tonight. We don't have a lot. Won't take us long to get through all this, and we'll get on to our reading here. Groups concerned over arming of domestic drones. With the use of domestic drones increasing, concern has not just come up over privacy issues, but also over the potential use of lethal force by unmanned aircraft. Drones have been used overseas to target and kill high-level terror leaders and are also being used along the U.S.-Mexico border in the battle against illegal immigration. But now these drones are starting to be used domestically at an increasing rate. The Federal Aviation Administration has allowed several police departments to use drones across the U.S. They are controlled from a remote location and use infrared sensors and high-resolution cameras. Chief Deputy Randy McDaniel of the Montgomery County Sheriff's Office in Texas told the Daily that his department is considering using rubber bullets and tear gas on its drone. Yeah. Always goddamn Texas first. Boy, if it's oppressive in nature, we do it down here first. I mean, I remember in the late 90s when we first started getting in the traffic cameras down here. We had them down here in Texas before anybody. This is back when W was governor. And I remember telling people then, hey, this is Brave New World, you know, straight the fuck up. We're here. This is straight up Brave New World. And people were like, oh, this is Big Brother. Oh, it's not Big Brother. Beep. Yeah. Now people don't really say that much anymore. They're quite aware of what it is now. Those are things that law enforcement utilizes day in and day out, and in certain situations it might be advantageous to have this type of system on an unmanned aerial vehicle, McDaniel said, told the Daily. The use of potential force from drones has raised the ire of the American Civil Liberties Union. Well, it's the big concern for me is not, is really when you can't see somebody, the person who's controlling these things, and you don't know who it is. You know, you don't know what that intent of that person is going to be. And they have created this because of that that natural, you know, that we find it very hard for it to kill another human being. And you sort of take away the personality when it's, you know, when you just got somebody behind a desk. They don't feel it's real. There's a disconnect. You know, it's like a video, becomes like a video game to them. And that's what scares me the most. And the idea of these being controlled by massive artificially intelligent supercomputers, don't like the idea of that. Because if you're, all these systems run on computer systems. They can be hijacked by anybody if somebody knows what they're doing. And I just, you know, I've seen too many movies, man. Again, like I said the other night, Chopping Mall. That's all I got to say. Two words, Chopping Mall. Boy, this is happening right here in my backyard. This is, I guess, but it's made the British papers, the Daily Mail. But there's one right down the street from my house. I remember a few years ago they had a big deal because they let people pay in pesos, but Pizza Patron is back in the news. If you ever need to get a lot of pizza really cheap and you're not really concerned with, you know, quality, it's great. I mean, you can go there and get like fucking five pizzas for like $20. Maybe more than that. I mean, they're like $3 or $4 or $5 each. They're totally cheap. They're not that great, but they're not that bad either. I've thrown down on the Pizza Patron before. But now they're having a promotion where if you go in and speak Spanish on June 5th at Pizza Patron, you get a free pizza. I'll go in there and talk in Spanish for a free pizza. What's the problem here? A Texan fast food company is set to cause controversy by giving away large pepperoni pizzas on the evening of June 5th to anyone who orders only in Spanish. Pizza Patron, a carryout chain headquartered in Dallas, will offer a $4.99 pizza to anyone who makes their order in fluent, first time, or broken Spanish. Oh shit, you can speak Spanglish in there? Well, fuck, I go speak some Spanglish to them real quick. See, the promotion comes as immigration, as a 2012 election issue simmers away, blah, 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 blah. Hey, well, who gives a fuck if you say it? Look, I'm, you know, I've for years refused to learn how to speak Spanish because, I mean, you can call me fucking right wing. You can call me racist. You can call me whatever you want. The fact of the matter is there is no logical reason why I should be guilted into learning Spanish. No logical reason. The predominant language here is English. That's what I grew up with, and that's what I speak. And, you know, I'm not going to learn Spanish so they can talk to me. They can learn English. Sorry, that's the way I am. Call me an asshole. But I will go in there and speak some Spanglish for a fucking pizza. There's just no doubt about it. Absolutely. What's the problem? It's a free pizza. Go in there and say, you know, ¿Dónde estás es pizza? And see what they say. What is your pizza? What? Oh, man, that's just too funny. It just makes me laugh what people get butthurt over. I don't know. It's a free pizza, dude. Lighten up. Who cares? What's politics got to do with it? Go get your free pizza and shut the fuck up. Say it in Spanish. Doesn't mean I'm going to learn how to speak Spanish. Doesn't mean I'm going to be fluent in it. But I still don't see a problem with it. You know, who cares? Who cares if they let you pay in pesos? Great. I had one of my listeners send me some Canadian money. Thank you, listener, for that. I don't really know how I'm going to exchange this, but thank you nonetheless. It's awesome. I've never seen Canadian money, and I've got some of it right here, actually. And what struck me as very interesting about your money is that your $20 bill has a gigantic. I mean, I thought usually you had to be dead before they put you on currency. Oh, no. Not in the case of the queen. The queen lizard beast. She gets to be on the bloody 20 in Canada, mate. I mean, big as shit, dude. Big green eyes. And then you like hold it up and like there's a little watermark, right? Any counterfeiting thing with a lizard beast in it too, so you get multiple profile shots, and it's got this big fuck off hologram silver. Like, you guys are serious about like not counterfeiting your money up there in Canada, huh? You guys must have had a problem with that. I mean, we didn't get serious about this shit till like the past, you know, 10-20 years, but my god, you guys got this shit looks like funny money. Exchange rate sucks dick nowadays. Fucking Canadian money's nearly almost as much as, I mean, I think his 50 bucks that he sent me is worth 47. I don't know where to exchange this stuff. They'll probably rape me. I'll probably get 30 bucks out of this, you know, after the whatever. But thank you. I mean, that's awesome. I've never seen Canadian money. You know, American money would be preferable, but I mean, I'll take it. It's rad. I mean, just to even see the money. But one of these bills had kind of weird like Mayan boat thing on it. Strange. It's like it looks like Mesoamerican type thing. What's that doing on Canadian money? That's strange. But thank you again to the listener who sent that to the PO box. That's really awesome. I was kind of like, whoa, wow, this is not but kinda, I could see it when I opened it up. And he sent a great letter in there too. I kind of like the PO box thing sometimes, you know, getting actual handwritten letters from people sometimes, you know, from all over the world. That's really cool to get one. We've had a few from Canada. That's just really awesome, you know, to see a handwritten note by somebody sometimes. And I opened it up and I was like, what kind of currency is this? It's like, well, that's Canadian money. I can see a lizard beast from here. Woman, 25 years old, arrested for chopping off the head of her 3-year-old nephew on the orders of a witchcraft guru. Oh, my God. It's the goddamn witchcraft gurus again. They're chopping people's heads off. Coming this summer, starring Tom Hanks. The head chopper witchcraft guru. This time, it's personal. A trainee which has admitted beheading her 3-year-old nephew on the orders of a dark arts teacher in Nepal, the 25-year-old was allegedly told her skills wouldn't only be complete after sacrificing her nephew and eldest son. Police in Nepal arrested the suspect in the town of Samanpur, south of the country's capital of Kathmandu, and charged her with sacrificing a child. Well, they actually have a law there. You didn't just here. It's just, you know, you sacrifice somebody, they just call it murder, you know. But there, they actually have a charge for sacrificing something. That's fucking rad. There should be a distinction, though, don't you think? I mean, you know, that brings up the whole moral issue of, you know, oh, well, if you murder somebody, well, that's, you know, you get the fucking chair, right? But if you murder somebody in a sacrifice, well, you know, then that whole right to engage in whatever religion you want to engage in comes up. And it's a constitutional issue. So here in the United States, they just decided to make it all across the board murder. You know, you got your capital murder. You got your manslaughter. You got your involuntary manslaughter. But to avoid any, you know, the constitutional loophole there, because that's what would happen to this country. It'd be, okay, you know, two separate penalties. Because, you know, hey, yes, they killed somebody, but they killed somebody practicing the religion they wanted to practice, and it was a sacrifice. So, you know, they should get a lesser penalty since it was a religious thing. Boy, there'd be motherfuckers getting sacrificed all over the place. Holy shit. Could you imagine? Oh, my God, man. It would be a fucking nightmare. People would be getting sacrificed all over the place in the United States for years and years and years up to this point. Who stand before the trial guilty of murder? I didn't murder anybody. That's my religion. It's my right. I sacrificed him on a cross, set him on fire for Jesus. It's my religion. It's my right. Don't try to take my constitutional right. Don't take my guns away. Pry from my cold, dead fingers. Maybe you'll be all over the place. Like, man, I'm tired of this bitch. That damn nagging at me all the fucking time. Ugh, on my ass to bring home fucking bread. Jesus. Tired of this bitch of shit. Ah, damn. Hey, honey, I'm thinking about doing a little sacrifice in the backyard. You want to join me? Yeah, I'll see you back there in a minute. No, I'm just going to go back in and get the hammer. I mean, my drink. No, not the hammer. I'll be back there in a minute. Hold on. So, wow. In Nepal, they actually have a designation for sacrificing someone. It's a different penalty than just straight-up murder. I did not know that. That's interesting. Mystery of Mars organic carbon deepens. Meteorites from the red planet did carry building blocks of life. Molecules containing large chains of carbon and hydrogen, the building blocks of all of life on Earth, are one of the main targets of man's mission to Mars, and key understanding if life ever existed on our neighboring planet. These molecules have previously been found in meteorites from Mars, but scientists have disagreed on where they came from. A new paper led by Carnegie's Andrew Steele provides strong evidence that this carbon did originate on Mars, although it does not seem to be biological in itself. These findings give researchers insight into the chemical processes taking place on Mars and will help aid future quests for evidence for ancient or modern Martian life. And as I've stated before, with cataclysms and everything that struck Mars, there'd be no reason, you know, we're looking at the surface from telescopes. There's no reason to think that whatever was on Mars in the past is now buried underground and you'd have to excavate archaeologically just like you would anything here on Earth. That's just going to be buried by the sands of time, literally. But I still think, we have these Mars articles we cover every now and again. And there definitely is an agenda for Mars, and there definitely is some wider thing they're going to come out with later. I really don't know what yet. I mean, it's still highly interesting to me that, you know, you've got the area on Mars where these pyramids are, and that area is called Cydonia, and it's on the 33rd degree parallel. And then that same area in the Middle East, the cradle of civilization, Mesopotamia, also on the 33rd degree parallel, was originally called Cydonia. But we're just told that's a coincidence. Yeah, that's a coincidence. Okay. All right. Mammoth bone flute proves that German cavemen played music in 40 3000 BC. Here we go. Pushing it farther and farther and back, aren't they, ladies and gentlemen? Don't be scared. These motherfuckers are getting scared now. They're pushing the shit back farther. Oh, yeah, 40,000 years. 40,000 BC. 50,000 BC. 60,000 BC. 80,000 BC. Can I hear 90? Can I hear 90? Can I hear 90? Can I hear 100? Can I hear 100? 100 BC. 100 BC. 100,000 BC. Sold. I mean, they're just pushing it farther and farther back. It's like, Jesus. Where were you 2 months ago? 2 months ago, that shit was still 10,000 years old. Now that I've been getting up here flapping my jaws about, you know, ancient pre-Hebrew Semites being in the United States 50,000 years old, like, oh, wait, put you back, put you back, put you back, put you back, put you back. Music was flourishing in Europe in 40,000 BC, millennia before Beethoven or the Beatles. Europeans' earliest ancestors were playing musical instruments and showing artistic creativity more than 40,000 years ago, a new study has shown. Evidence of the musicians was unearthed in Germany in the form of primitive flutes made from bird bones and mammoth ivory. A new system of fossil dating confirmed the age of animal bones excavated in the same rock layers as the instruments and examples of early art. The bones, probably the remains of meals, bore cuts and marks from hunting and eating. The finds described in the Journal of Human Evolution are from the Gesen-Dosteri cave in the Swabian Jura region of southern Germany. They show the Argonacian culture, a way of living linked with early modern humans, existed at that site between 42,000 and 50,000 years, or 42,000 and 43,000 years ago. Now, that's interesting. Manly P. Hall says Atlantis fell 50,000 years ago. The DNA evidence extracted from Cherokees says that their ancestry goes back to one European ancestor that came from, you know, fucking Galilee and Israel 50,000 years ago. There was a science article. You can Google this and find it out. Type imagination 50,000 years ago and see what comes up. Because there was an article that came out a couple of years ago that I have that says right at 50,000 years ago was when we started to have imagination for the first time. So I keep coming around that date 40-something thousand, 50-something thousand years ago in a lot of different places. Oh, you're going to love this. This is just no shit here. Oxford University project starts serious hunt for Yeti using DNA samples from around the world. I still think, you know, Yetis and Bigfoots and all that stuff were part of the genetic manipulation they were doing. And some of these got out, and some of these were let out into the wild and survived in small numbers. But I think they're kind of like Cro-Magnon, you know, part animal, part human type things that, you know, chimeras possibly. And Oxford College is to analyze samples of Yeti hair and teeth in one of the most serious attempts yet made to track down the elusive and possibly mythical species. Wolfson College is asking for samples of hair and teeth of cryptids, unknown animals such as the Yeti, and is to use the latest DNA technology to analyze samples from around the world. As part of a larger inquiry into the genetic relationship between our own species, Homo sapiens, and other hominids, we invite submissions of organic material from formerly undescribed species or cryptids for the purpose of their species identification by genetic means, says the college. Well, I'm going to be following this. There'll be no telling what they're going to come up with. I bet they're going to find stuff just like they found with humans. You know? That's what's so great about the new DNA research they're getting now, because it's giving them more questions than it is answers. And a lot of people don't want to know these questions. You know, they're like, what? Why? You know, why does King Tut's ancestry trace back to Eastern Europe? It doesn't make any sense. Yeah, well, yeah, it makes perfect sense if you're looking at it from a certain perspective. But I think that's incredible to see that, you know. It's DNA evidence starting to go, oh, wait a second. You know, like the old paradox. It all made sense to me when I was reading Lost Book of Enki here on the show. The part where they were talking about how they brought, there wasn't sufficient food for their creations and for them to eat, so they brought different animals and different things like that from their planet here. And when I read that, it just fucking clicked, man. A light bulb went off. When, oh, shit, I get it now. You know the old paradox? Which came first, the chicken or the egg? And how we can never answer that question because, you know, for there to be a chicken, right, there first had to be an egg. But who was the chicken that laid the egg if there wasn't a chicken around? Because it was the first one, right? Well, there you go. That's the answer to the paradox. The answer to the paradox is that you don't know which came first, the chicken or the egg, because the chicken was introduced into our environment from somewhere else. That's why we have that paradox. You can't answer where it came from. Well, they can. The Anunnaki can, I guess. Experts warn that hundreds of bones will wash up on the U.S. beaches as 1.5 million tons of tsunami debris reaches North America. Well, that's comforting. That's just what you want to see this summer when you go out to the beach, isn't it? You have a fucking femur come up and knock you upside the head in a wave. West Coast beachcombers are likely to stumble across some gruesome discoveries over the next few months as experts warn that human remains are set to reach the shore. Radioactive, probably, too. Don't touch them, motherfuckers. God damn. Dozens of bones are expected to wash up as part of the jetsam from last year's Japanese tsunami. In total, an estimated 1.5 million tons of debris is believed to be on the 3,500-mile journey from Japan to Alaska and other parts of North America. Oceanographer Kurt Ebesmeyer warned this week that the findings would include human remains, which will need to be handled sensitively by those who find them. We're expecting 100 sneakers with bones in them, he said on Monday. Anyone who discovers such remains should call 911 and wait for police. Don't take them home and make necklaces out of them. I didn't say that, but I added that. But still, you know, was that band where the fucking lead singer blew his head off? The guys made necklaces out of his skull and shit? Jesus. So, I mean, yeah, I guess this was to be expected. How many people died in that fucking thing? 70,000 or some shit? Panic spreads across Georgia as fourth victim of flesh-eating bacteria has leg amputated. Yeah, somebody dropped a bioweapon in Georgia. A fourth victim of flesh-eating bacteria in Georgia has lost his leg when doctors were forced to amputate it 3 weeks after he received a cut in the water. People are getting cut, random little cuts of nothing, and they're getting flesh-eating disease, and it's destroying and ravaging their bodies, and they're having to have fucking parts removed. This fits the bill for an intentional bioweapons release, and it wouldn't surprise me. I mean, stuff just didn't come out of the blue like this and be this widespread and not be a bioweapon. From Lyme disease, which one of our listeners contacted us, said he had and was diagnosed with and has been fighting, and said that the show's really been an inspiration for him and helped him get through fighting that Lyme disease. It's just awesome. We wish him the best. He was, you know, whittled down to nothing. He fought his way back up, you know. And Lyme disease, absolutely. Bioweapon. You can look it up. And there's many of them, and that's what this sounds like here. The latest outbreak of the infection has left neighbors terrified to go in Lake Sinclair, afraid they'll come down with a rare and serious disease. I suspect this probably... It's also a direct result of the Schaff chemtrail spraying. I mean, that stuff, it's that white filament powder, man. They spray it up there at 30,000, 40,000, 50,000 feet. It falls through the atmosphere and the layer up there with all of the crud and bacteria in it. It falls down to the ground. It goes in lakes. It goes in fish. I mean, hell, I almost won't even eat wild fish anymore, man, but just because of the mercury content and everything else and bacteria. One of the chicks got this stuff ziplined and got cut on a zip line and had to have hands, fingers, legs, all kinds of shit amputated. Pretty much everything except her head and her torso. And it was a week after South Park had the episode, I should never have gone ziplining. And a week later, somebody gets flesh-eating bacteria. That was just too odd. Undercover U.S. agents brought down our new superjet. Russia's extraordinary claim about crash which killed 45. Uh-oh. Spy sources in Moscow today made the astonishing claim that a U.S. undercover operation may have sabotaged a new Russian superjet plane that crashed in Indonesia 2 weeks ago. The aircraft was on a demonstration flight amid lucrative orders when it slammed into a mountain, killing all 45 passengers and crew. We are investigating the theory that it was industrial sabotage, a GRU military intelligence source said. The extraordinary Cold War-style claim echoes high-level allegations in Moscow that the U.S. used powerful lasers to zap a Russian Mars probe 7 months ago. Other satellite launches that there have been half a dozen failures in the last 18 months might have been the work of U.S. sabotage, raising the specter of sustained campaign against its technology by American Secret Service. A headline to a story in Russia's biggest newspaper today read, "Are the Americans implicated in the superjet crash?" Now, they're ramping it up now, aren't they? Sounds like a provocateur situation to get the Russians pissed off at us so that, you know, we can get some shit started. They're trying to just get, some shit going, aren't they? Every turn, they're just trying to kick up dirt where it didn't even need to be kicked up. Every time. Get a drink real quick. Revealed ancient Appalachian people who boasted of Portuguese ancestry to avoid slavery were actually descended from African men and white women. Varied and sometimes wild claims have been made about the origins of a group of dark-skinned Appalachian residents once known densively as the Melungeons. Some speculated they were descended from Portuguese explorers or perhaps from Turkish slaves or gypsies. Now a new DNA study in the Journal of Genetic Genealogy attempts to separate truth from oral tradition and wishful thinking. The study found the truth to be somewhat less exotic. Genetic evidence shows that the families historically called Melungeons are the offspring of sub-Saharan African men and white women of Northern or Central European origin. Uh-oh, not Portuguese. And that report, which was published in April in the peer-reviewed journal, doesn't sit comfortably with some people who claim Melungeon ancestry. You just woke up and got told you're a half-breed. Yeah, I bet there's some people pissed off about that shit. You know? But the DNA doesn't lie, man. I mean, the Cherokee swore up and down they were Jews and from Jew ancestry. But when they ran their DNA, it all went back to a European ancestor. Same thing with Tutankhamun. I mean, you know, the people got to quit being so attached to this identity of a flag or a country or a race or a color or anything else. You know, I mean, folks, we. You know, this DNA evidence should show you that we just don't have and haven't had all of the facts up to this point to be so, you know, divided and so militaristic about color and race and genetics and background and you know, origin of where somebody's from. I mean, we just don't know all the answers. But people have this pride about their race or this pride about their tribe or, you know, whatever have you. And, boy, they don't like it when the DNA evidence crushes that because, in a way, to them, it crushes their identity. So it also makes you wonder if that's another element in all this. In recent decades, interest in the origins of the Melungeons has risen dramatically in advances both in DNA research and in the advent of internet resources that allow individuals to trace their ancestry without digging through dusty archives. G. Reginald Daniel, a sociologist at the University of California, Santa Barbara, who spent more than 30 years examining multiracial people in the U.S. and wasn't part of this research, said the study is more evidence that race mixing in the U.S. isn't a new phenomenon. Oh, man. Yeah, that's going to piss off some of these KKK motherfuckers when they find out they got the ancient black man in them. Oh, they're not going to be happy about that at all. That's just going to be too damn funny. Well, we're going to leave it there with the news for tonight. I thank everybody for being here with us tonight. We're going to take a break and come back and get into our series of reading for you here tonight. TheGlobalReality.com is my website. Please support our work there. Next week is our fundraising week, and we have to reach our goal by Thursday, no later than Thursday. So please help us out there. You want to support this project so I can get this pitch and get this thing cut together so I can hopefully get this idea on TV. Please support us so we can get that going too. That's really what I need to support more now more than anything. You know, to be able to get this done, you know, not the film, the whole film done, but at least get this promo reel done. You know, because, I mean, this is looking like this is going to happen, man. TheGlobalReality.com is our website. So please support us there if you can. P.O. Box, if you absolutely can't use PayPal. And we will take a break, come back, and get into more. Stay with us. I didn't have a song queued. Give me a second here.
uncensored, no holds barred talk. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. This is the Global Reality Radio Network.
Back here with you on the Global Reality, right here on the Global Reality Radio Network. I'm your host, Josh Reeves. Thanks for staying up with us for another late night Moonbat edition of the broadcast. We appreciate it so much, and thank you to everybody out there listening on YouTube or an archive show later on during your day. Hope that you're enjoying the show. TheGlobalReality.com is my website, and please go there and support our work. Thanks to everybody who has and continues to do so. If we could get another $200 in here this week, we would be good to go until our fundraising show next week. So bear that in mind and go to TheGlobalReality.com and help out. Any amount, small or large, is always helpful. Doesn't matter. I've only got mad at one person for donating a small amount only one time, and it was because they donated 50 cents, which I got 35 cents of after fees. Then they came in the chat room and berated me for not talking to them. So I refunded their fucking 50 cents and said, you know what? Keep it and consider that my donation to you to fuck off. I mean, look, I understand times are hard. You know, you can only donate $10 or $20 or something, whatever. That's fine. But come on. You know, people that donate hundreds don't come and scream at me and say, you're going to talk to me right now because I donated to you. But that's what this person did, and like not saying, not telling people when they were yelling at me that they donated 50 cents. You know what I mean? So somebody sees that. That's how you know that kind of shit's an operation. Somebody sees that and thinks, oh, you know, he won't talk to this person even though they donated. He's an asshole. Well, yeah, that person didn't offer up the information. They donated 50 cents. Give me a fucking break. She was an Aussie broad, too. No wonder you Aussie guys are always looking for women outside of fucking Australia. Jesus. Heard they like American dudes, though. Chapter 7, Lost Worlds of Ancient America. That Viking settlers established themselves in Newfoundland at a place called L'Anse aux Meadows is well known. But further evidence of the Norse and other foreigners in prehistoric Canada is far less acknowledged, despite some intriguing evidence. Well, shit. Canada, nothing. United States, too. In August 1972, Don French took up residence in the small town of Pushthrough, an outpost 30 miles west of Bay du Nord on the south coast island of Newfoundland. While there, she heard strange tales of the legendary Stone Cross, a structure supposedly venerated by local Mi'kmaq Indians for centuries before the arrival of modern European immigrants. No one had actually seen it, and its whereabouts were unknown. Curious to learn more, French studied native traditions, which described a sacred precinct, lonely and barren, where people in need of healing would find a large, unusually shaped cross spread out on the ground. It was the site of supposedly miraculous cures, but over time, with the advent of modern medicine, the place was abandoned to myth. The Mi'kmaqs are an interesting people. Their name means allies, a reference to the confederacy of clans they formed and led, thus becoming the largest and most important native tribe in Canada's eastern maritime provinces. A seasonally nomadic people, the Mi'kmaq's Algonquin dialect differs greatly from that of their neighbors and has some suggestion of Scandinavian cognates. Their possible linguistic links to medieval Europe are underscored by what appear to be Nordic recessive gene traits among the Mi'kmaq, which include recurring blondness, and especially by the discovery at the island's northern extreme of the first professionally authenticated Viking site in the New World at L'Anse aux Meadows, today a National Historic Park. Even more intriguing, the late epigrapher Dr. Barry Fell demonstrated a fascinating parallel between Mi'kmaq birch bark script and ancient Egyptian hieroglyphs. What, if anything, these possible prehistoric themes may have to do with the lost stone cross of southern Newfoundland, French could not be sure. But she was determined to find out. Basing her work primarily on old legends, she compiled a rough map that took her inland from the Bay du Nord and over the high cliffs of Devil's Dining Table. On their opposite side, in a barren plain surrounded by hills thick with spruce trees, she eventually found the object of her quest. It was spread out on the arid ground, the huge outline of a diamond-shaped cross, as though opening itself up from the center. Measuring 30 feet from north to south, it more closely resembled a compass. The design was encircled by a ring of numerous white stones, some of bolder proportions, others piled into rough heaps, mimicking crude towers or the abstract configuration of statues. They sound like mounds. From the vantage point of one of these piles, French could make out the faint image of a man upon the cross. Not in a crucified position, but as though emerging from the diamond opening. Oh, yeah. That's a fucking, that's a straight up Stargate portal reference. She remembered a Mi'kmaq tradition concerning these stones. It was permissible for a visitor to remove one to keep it for his or her own healing purposes as long as he or she replaced it with another. Two stone basins lay near the south end of the structure, one perhaps for ablutions, the other for donations. In the latter, she found several old coins, a single example dated 1865. French had discovered, perhaps rediscovered, the stone cross, but answers were not forthcoming. How old was it? Who made it? And why? Who was the last to see it before us? What illnesses did it supposedly cure? Beyond these questions, she experienced a feeling of profound wonder, a sensation of being in a sacred zone, a sacrosanct area with an emotional character all its own, not frightening, but certainly powerful. If the stone cross of Newfoundland is Norse, its diamond shape renders it a most peculiar Christian design occurring nowhere else. Its compass-like configuration might refer to a kind of Christ of the Mariners for Vikings far from home, even if that home were only at L'Anse Aux Meadows. It could also pass for an icon of that other people who supposedly impacted the Mi'kmaqs, the ancient Egyptians. For them, Ossar, better known by his Greek name Osiris, the man-god of resurrection, was a proto-Christian concept associated with the cross of the four cardinal directions. Despite the presence of a male figure, the Newfoundland cross is not a crucifix. Whether Christ or Osiris or someone altogether different, the man received homage in the recent past, judging from the mid-19th century coins left at the site in apparent offerings. But Mi'kmaq traditions indicate a prehistoric origin for the design. It is among the most baffling of all sacred centers, offering determined investigators far too clues for constructing even the most tenuous explanation. However, Newfoundland's stone cross is not the only object of its kind discovered in Canada. During 1964, archaeologist Thomas E. Lee was scouting near an excavation underway near the village of Imaha in northern Quebec when he found a tall, curious monument on the desolate north bank of the Payne Estuary. Yeah, you Canadians listeners out there, y'all need to be paying attention to this chapter. Might want to go back and review this again, write stuff down. 15 miles north of the village of Payne Bay, near the west coast of Ungava Bay, the 2-ton stone structure stands 8 feet high and measures 4.5 feet across at its pointed lintel, surmounted by a 14-inch high capstone. While the pillar was a surprise to Lee and his colleagues, he later learned from native Inuit, that they had known of its existence for generations. Yet they laid no claim to it, insisting that the strange object was already standing long before the first of their ancestors arrived in that area. Moreover, the Inuit never worked in stone on such a large scale. Lee was struck by its roughly Nordic design and dubbed it the Hammer of Thor. Possibly a direction indicator, it appears to point toward the remains of a rectangular stone structure 80 feet long and 30 feet across not far away. Slanting walls, half buried in the hard ground, resemble a Viking longhouse from the 10th or 11th century. Greenland is not very far from this point in Quebec, so Norse visitors 1,000 years ago could have sailed the distance in their sturdy dragon ships and left a memorial to their arrival. Lee's characterization of the Ungava Bay object as a hammer of Thor does not seem inappropriate. Similar stone structures appeared throughout Viking Age Scandinavia. The Temple of Thor in Sweden dates before 1125 AD. We know that Nordic seafarers voyaged at least as far as Newfoundland, and that they certainly did not lack ships to bring them to Quebec from relatively nearby Greenland. Thor's hammer was the most commonly reproduced religious object of the period. Known as the Mjolnir, it was envisioned as the lightning as it flew from the storm god's hand. He was the patron deity of fertility, but also of courage and decisive action. Thor has been portrayed in saga and art as a virile middle-aged man of great power, with long red hair and a beard. Hey, that's me. I got long red hair and a beard. He was sometimes shown being carried across the universe in a great chariot drawn by rams. The thousand-year-old Quebec monument was probably set up to call upon his strength of will in a difficult land. Interestingly, a bronze statuette circa 1000 AD from northern Iceland depicting Thor with his hammer portrays him wearing a conical hat, virtually identical to the headgear worn by male figures appearing at Ontario's Petroglyph Provincial Park, a collection of native rock art featuring dozens of pre-Columbian illustrations. Well, he had a conical helmet. Maybe he had a conical-shaped skull. Mjolnir was not merely a symbol for meteorological events, however. The gods of Valhalla proclaimed it the single most valuable object they possessed, and its likeness appears to have been reproduced by Norse shamans for hallowing marriage rites, to bless the recently departed souls of the dead at funerals, and to consecrate newborns into the community. Mjolnir's image was inscribed on a Swedish tombstone at Stenkvista. It thus resembles a higher symbol of the birth-death duality, not unlike the sacred double-headed axe of the Bronze Age, particularly as realized in Minoan Crete. In a particularly revealing myth of Thor and his hammer, he restores the dead to life through the potency of its magic. As Davidson writes, it would seem indeed as though the power of the thunder god, symbolized by his hammer, extended over all that had to do with the well-being of the community. It covered birth, marriage and death, burial and cremation ceremonies, weapons and feasting, traveling, land taking, and the making of oaths between men. The famous weapon of Thor was not only the symbol of the destructive power of the storm and of fire from heaven, but also a protection against the forces of evil and violence. Canada's ancient mysteries predate the arrival of Vikings 1,000 years ago. More accessible than either the stone cross or Thor's hammer, Serpent Mounds Provincial Park is located south of Highway 7 near the town of Keene, Ontario. You guys have a serpent mound in Canada too? Why the fuck did I not know that? Listen, Canadian listeners, I know there's a bunch of you out there. I get emails from you all the time and have for years. Got some, and I've been getting emails from people in Canada saying, hey, what can we do? Is there anything we can film up here? Well, here you go, Canada. You better pay close attention to this show tonight. My goodness, you guys have Serpent Mounds Provisional Park, located south of Highway 7 in the town of Keene, Ontario. Hey, here you go. I did not know that. That's weird, wild stuff. I did not know that. I didn't know that. Wow. Visitors may admire the 194-foot-long effigy of a prehistoric snake. Please, I'm begging you, somebody go out and give me some footage of this. Of a prehistoric snake winding across a hill among a dark grove of oak trees on the northern shore of Rice Lake. See, again, they say right here that was before the Vikings even. Yeah, these are those Amorite fuckers I'm on the trail of. 6 feet high with an average of 25 feet, the effigy was sculpted from the earth about 2,000 years ago to form a serpentine burial mound. Eight smaller oval mounds surrounded the figure, although unique in Canada. Two similar geoglyphs lie in the United States, one in Adams County, Ohio, of course, and the other in Rice County, Kansas. Didn't know about that one either. The serpent egg motif is also found in ancient Mexico, Greece, and Egypt, but the Canadian example is the most northerly of all. Although separate mounds were excavated as early as 1895, the most thorough investigation was conducted between 1955 and 1960 by the Royal Ontario Museum and Trent University under the direction of Richard B. Johnston. Most of what has been learned about the site stems from his work. He found that the earthworks were built shortly after 200 BC, but never used for permanent settlement. Instead, they represented a ceremonial center occupied only during late spring and summer months for ritual purposes. Although 3,412 pottery fragments have been uncovered at the site, there is no evidence of permanent habitation. The biomorph was officially identified with the so-called Point Peninsula culture, a group of hunter-gatherers who resided in the Rice Lake area, but such a supposition is problematic because representatives of this culture never built mounds. As Minister of Ontario's Natural Resources, Vincent G. Cario, explained, these mound builders were not a typical band of Point Peninsula peoples. Skull features in particular show the mound builders to represent a different stock, different yet related to their presumed descendants, the Ontario Iroquois. Also, unlike the Point Peninsula residents, the builders of serpent mounds were metalsmiths working in silver and copper. There you go. There they are. There's my boys. And their distinctive pottery, wholly superior to anything that came before, shares the same zigzag pattern found in the great ceremonial site of Oslon in southern Wisconsin. 3 miles east of Rock Lake, there are other links to Oslon. Ritually broken clamshells, turtle carpuses, and dogs, all funerary elements typical of Osloners, were found at Serpent Mounds. It seems clear that the builders of the Serpent Mounds were not native to Ontario, but came from the South. Here we go. Man, oh man, oh man. Right in line with what I've been finding. As the archaeologist W.A. Kenyon wrote, originally we feel these serpents must have been conceived in the jungles of Central America or Mexico. As they moved north, their ranks gradually thinned, for the harsh climate of the higher northern latitudes is not suitable for top tropical serpents. And so the last surviving members of that strange breed came to rest in Ontario on the flank of the pre-Columbian Shield. Now notice that this W.A. Kenyon guy refers to these people as the serpents. As the serpents. I've never seen that. I mean, I know of serpent worship, that being a predominant religion before Christianity. Behold, I've cast out the serpents. But they're saying, they're calling this the suitable for tropical. Let me read this again. These mound builders that came from the South. As the archaeologist W.A. Kenyon wrote, originally, we feel these serpents, now remember, they're talking about a race of people here, must have been conceived in the jungles of Central America or Mexico. As they moved north, their ranks gradually thinned, for the harsh climate of the higher northern latitudes is not suitable for tropical serpents. They're literally calling these people serpents like they're snakes. That's fucking weird. Never have I ever seen anything referenced like that before. Let me get a pen, write this down, or type it in your search engine. W.A. Kenyon, K-E-N-Y-O-N. W as in Walter, A as in apple, K-E-N-Y-O-N. Originally, we feel these serpents must have been conceived in the jungles of Central America or Mexico. As they moved north, their ranks gradually thinned, for the harsh climate of the higher northern latitudes is not suitable for tropical serpents. And so the last surviving member of that strange breed came to rest in Ontario on the flank of the Precambrian Shield. Oh, my goodness. Were the builders of serpent mounds the Mayas, who came all the way from Yucatan for the high-grade copper they needed for the ceremonial cities far to the south? Nope. This is way before them. Or were they Aslan miners who likewise raised a huge snake effigy at the shore of their sacred necropolis in Rock Lake? In ancient eternal symbolism implicit in the altered landscape of serpent mounds survives. Though the site is certainly a place of the dead, it is also a temple of rebirth. Interred bodies were found in the flexed or fetal position as though curled up in the womb, waiting to be born. The individual mounds resemble Earth Mother wombs, swollen with new life. Linked together to form a serpent, they reinforce the rebirth concept because of the snake's ability to slough off its old skin for a new one. The numerical significance of the mounds is no less telling. 8 egg-shaped earthworks encircle the major figure. Whereas an egg theme underscores the principle of new life, 8 is traditionally associated with death, the 8 legs of a spider that kills to live, the 8 hours we sleep each night, and so forth. Here, the two interact and separate parts of the same forces for transitional change, life, death, rebirth. Together, the effigies comprise 9 mounds. 9 stands for the female powers of rebirth, as exemplified in the 9 months of pregnancy. Serpent Mound's close proximity to Petroglyph Provincial Park is not coincidental. Both sites are unique in their own right, but undoubtedly share some sacred relationship. If so, then the incised image do indeed date much earlier than supposed, to 2,000 or more years ago. More. Perhaps under the Serpent Mounds of Rice Lake lie the remains of the artists who carved the mysterious petroglyphs. So there you go, Canada. And next time on the show, we'll be getting into some stuff in Florida. So you Floridians, I know we got some of you out there. Chapter 8, Prehistoric Mooring Stones of Florida. We'll get into that next time. So, yeah, definitely you people in Florida, pay attention. Canada, there's one for you. Hope that gives you something to chew on, again, something to maybe look at. Hey, yeah, Canadians, let me know if you guys can go and check that out. Be interested and see what you can find. Maybe live tomorrow night, may not be. I don't know. We'll see what happens. I'll try my best. But either way, we do need your support. We've got a $200 goal set this week. We need to meet that so we can keep slugging forward because it's getting real, baby. As my buddy Steven Salinas, I don't know if he's listening later on maybe, but Steven, if you are, this one's for you because he said this on Facebook. Shit's getting real. It's getting real, son. But yeah, it's awesome. I'm just very excited about what the future holds, but we got to make it till then. And I need your help to make it to then, yeah, because big things are in the works, folks. So please donate and support if you can because it's happening. But I need your help to get there, and I can't make it there without you. TheEagleReality.com is my website. My name is Josh Reeves, and I love each and every one of you, and we'll see you next time for the broadcast. You guys have yourself a great one. Take care.